This is your Uncle Don, the Direst of Circumstances, coming to you with my 121st show on the 25th of January, 2005. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Contact me via email at the following address, uncledon@cfur.ca. I'd love to hear from you, and drop me a note, Bunny. My shows have been characterized by some as the place on the CFUR calendar where seldom is heard an encouraging word. Maybe so, but there are times in world history for optimism, and times for pessimism. I don't know how many people are truly optimists today, but I honor the ones who plug along as though they are optimistic. It takes dedication, courage, and a bit of willful blindness to carry on with progressive projects in the face of today's grim reality. I take my hat off to those who work to oppose climate change, unemployment, sickness, exploitation, and right-wing know-nothing radicalism. Organizations like the Red Cross, Oxfam, UNICEF, the Canadian Friends Service Committee, United Way, and myriad others try to ameliorate the effects of a brutal society and an uncaring nature. Their work is precious and encouraging, but they're overwhelmed by the destructive forces that are loosed upon us, most of which are of our own making. There have been times when I've been optimistic. It's just that none of them have been recent. I don't actually remember this, but when Japan surrendered, I rode my tricycle up and down our street shouting, "The war is over!" I had only the vaguest idea of what a war was, but I knew that the end of one was good because toys and butter would soon be back in the stores. I did not know that the age of atomic terror had begun. I was optimistic in the early 50s as European colonies in Africa were gradually given their independence, only to descend into civil war and exploitation by their new dictators. I was optimistic when Nikita Khrushchev began to dismantle the repressive apparatus of the Soviet Empire's Stalinist past, only to be thwarted by new Cold War incidents which reintroduced the influence of the hardliners. I was optimistic when the apparently idealistic John Kennedy promised peace in the world and overdue racial equality at home. Then came the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the birth of the war against Vietnam. I was optimistic when Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty, which sought to make the United States a shining proof that capitalism could provide the peace and prosperity that had been promised before only by communists. That optimism disappeared in the flash of napalm and the blast of cluster bombs as the new war on poverty morphed into a war against a poor society on the other side of the world. I was optimistic in 1968 when Eugene McCarthy, running on a platform of peace in Vietnam, forced Lyndon Johnson to withdraw from his run for re-election. My hopes were dashed when Richard Nixon won the presidential election, only to carry on with that war. I was optimistic as the old Soviet Empire reformed drastically, culminating in the fall of the Berlin Wall and the release of its colonies in Eastern Europe. Hopes for peace and cooperation were dashed when George Bush Sr., followed by William Clinton, chose to take over the Soviet Union's mantle as the world's evil empire, intent upon conquering the world for the benefit of American capitalism's insatiable appetite. Since that precious opportunity for world peace and cooperation was blown, I've had scant occasion to be optimistic. Optimism can lead to serious letdowns. I was wildly optimistic when I first came to Canada. The United States was wallowing in the ongoing disaster of the Vietnam War, and the mood back there was ugly. Suddenly I found myself in a peaceful country that was charting its own course, and as independently as possible from the giant to the south. Up here the word socialist was not yet an epithet. We had a federal government that acted as though a better world was possible. What a change! I suppose it was my initial optimism that led me to be so critical when I see my adopted country taken over by a crew of venal bastards who cannot see beyond the advancement of their social class at the expense of Canada's past ideals. The supreme goal of politicians in power is now to retain that power at any price. While paying lip service to the good of our society, they enrich themselves and their friends. They sell out our independence through treasonous treaties that erode our democratic freedom to the detriment to determine our own path. The danger of accidental or deliberate nuclear war still hangs over our heads. Although we've had ample opportunity to dismantle these, the ultimate weapons of mass destruction. Even as the Cold War was winding down, some nations continue to refine their nuclear weapons with the object of using them tactically instead of holding them as pawns in a balance of power. I mention no names. We're hell-bent on destroying the very nature of which we are a part. We're not the first generation to try this, but we're the first generation that has the power to destroy sustainability for the entire planet, even without resorting to nuclear war. There's a long record of civilizations that destroyed themselves by overexploiting the natural systems that sustained them. The Sumerians destroyed the farmland of Mesopotamia through their irrigation. Mayans cut down their forests and destroyed the soils. Easter Islanders wrecked their entire ecosystem, leaving only stone heads as reminders of their folly. The Roman Empire deforested most of the Mediterranean basin, rendering the land barren. Haiti was a paradise in the estimation of Christopher Columbus. Now it is a wasteland. And how are we now treating our planet? We're destroying the tropical forests of the Amazon. We dam rivers and pollute the waters across the planet. We plunder the fossil fuels of our land, leaving mounds of sterile slag on the ground, poisons in the waters, and greenhouse gases in the air. Our cities cover our best farmland, while our fishers deplete the once vast life in the oceans. Our leaders pay lip service to correcting the damage through token actions like the Kyoto Accord, but no society is willing to make the drastic withdrawal from the abyss by really converting to a sustainable economy. Growth is the watchword and the standard by which our success is judged, although we all know intuitively that exponential growth of our population and use of resources is at the root of our problems. What a legacy we're leaving for our children. There are disconcerting leaks surfacing in the press indicating that Paul Martin has already made concessions preparatory to Canada's participating in the American Star Wars project. I don't doubt these stories, as Martin's background is in business, and a good business case can be made for our joining Star Wars, whether it be folly or not. There will be spin-offs and contracts for research and equipment, as well as work in constructing facilities. That is the carrot. The stick is hidden in the ongoing battle between the U.S. Department of Commerce and our softwood lumber industry, and the number of petty border harassments to which we are vulnerable. Our cattle industry is open to continued embargo under the guise of a health issue if we do not cooperate with Star Wars. The pressure to become an accomplice in this project presents Canada with one of those rare, clear cases where we have to decide whether to do that which is profitable or that which is right. As a supposedly sovereign nation, we should be able to make that choice free from outside pressure. That's not the way the world works, but it's an ideal that we could wish for. If we want to look critically at Bush's ballistic missile defense, we should look at the real issue and not the shadow on the wall cast by the propaganda of its proponents. The reality is that this system is not intended to protect the population of any country from ballistic missiles. It's well known that a heavy offensive strike could overwhelm any defense that is currently envisioned. By the simple method of launching massive numbers of missiles and decoys, a good percentage of bombs could get to their targets. These bombs are of a nature that one is too many and a few would be crippling. The missile defense system is actually a critical part of a first strike capability as envisioned by American planners. The U.S. military is dependent on satellite systems for communications and intelligence. A potential enemy would want to knock these satellites out of action, and weapons in space would be critical to defending them. With the satellites protected and weapons overhead, the American military could control any potential battlefield. The supposedly benign program that we are being enticed to join is the first step in putting those weapons up there. Once we've begun to allow this, there's no clear point at which we can back out without facing drastic punishment. The only point at which we can demur is right now, before we begin. We should also be looking at our participation in all aspects of the American space program. The new head of NASA, Sean O'Keefe, a former underling of Dick Cheney's, in his first news conference announced that everything NASA now does will be of dual use, meaning that every space mission would test technologies for both civilian and military uses. The mission to Mars, currently projected to cost $500 billion, will test nuclear engines of great military potential. The mission to blast a hole in a comet has obvious value for testing explosives in the vacuum of space. And so it goes. If Canada should bite the bullet, telling the Bush regime we do not agree with the weaponization of space in any of its aspects, we would not be without power to retaliate for any American reactions. The U.S. desperately needs our energy resources, which gives us tremendous leverage. This is an area where we should be doing that which is right, not which is expedient. I seldom go to the movies anymore. What was once an exciting adventure has now taken on the aura of a trip to a casino, an opportunity to have my pocket picked under bright lights. Many things have changed my attitude toward movie theaters. The first is the obvious greed of the theater owners, who are no longer local entrepreneurs, but massive foreign chains intent upon maximizing profit by minimizing choice. We once had several movie theaters in Prince George. Now we have one. There was a time when Tuesdays offered those on a budget the opportunity to see movies at a discount. No more. There was a time when a major alternative to a trip to the movies was a night with insipid television. Now we have relatively inexpensive movie rentals. With a rental, we can watch what we want, when we want, and stop the action to make a snack instead of lining up at a counter for overpriced junk food. The relevant question for me is now not why I do not go to a movie theater, but why I would go. When I want entertainment in town, I find live theater in Prince George is more interesting and not much more expensive. We have two excellent legitimate theater companies in town that deserve our support more than the foreign movie chain movie theater. There was a time when I enjoyed movies. In Oakland, California, there was a privately run movie theater that was always well attended and fun. Their secret of success, when the chains were nearly empty, was that this theater did not compete for the first-run films, but ran movies that had already made the rounds of the major theaters, and they charged just $1 for admission. Granted that this was a long time ago, and $1 then was like $3 now, it was still cheap. Every so often, the friends I lived with would spontaneously decide to go to this theater. We usually didn't even check to see what was playing. If the movie was bad, there was always the pub across the street. This theater had its own security officer, sort of. We tried to get there early, not just to get good seats, but to see the live show as this rent-a-cop strutted the floor, brandishing his nightstick and attempting to keep order. He would stride across the stage, staring at the audience, threatening mayhem as we all heckled him. It was all a good-natured game. When the lights were dimmed for the show, the audience looked like it was infested with fireflies as the glow from passing joints flared. The above opinions are rationalizations justifying an attitude that comes with age. This is something you can look forward to as you age. Someday, you should live so long, you may be an old curmudgeon like me. Something to live for. There's another aspect of movies that is irritating to anyone disturbed by the intrusion of advertising into all aspects of our lives. That is, of course, the so-called product placement. This goes beyond the subtle glimpse of a Budweiser beer can in the hand of a famous actor. Product placement even influences content, as that lucrative glimpse of the beer brand assures that the actor will not make a fool of himself under the influence. The script might be changed to accommodate that bit of advertising. There is a company, A-List Entertainment Incorporated, that reviews movie scripts in search of scenes where products can be promoted. The major movie studios have units which sell advertising space in their pictures. Revenues from this not-so-subtle advertising can be substantial, ranging from $500,000 to millions for a single film. Placements can be small flashes of a brand, or the movie can be built around them, as was a recent movie whose name escapes me, which was a virtual 90-minute advertisement for Federal Express. Computer technology is making it possible to tailor placements to the market in which the movie is shown. For instance, the local version of Spider-Man 2 featured a logo of Dr. Pepper's on a refrigerator. Overseas, that was altered to Mirinda, a brand of soft drink marketed by PepsiCo outside of North America. The art of altering movies to fit the market is in its infancy, but I would extrapolate this to the point where local advertisers can have their logos inserted in movies playing in a particular city at minimal cost. I eagerly await the opportunity to sit in an overpriced seat in a local theater while being entertained by an inane film built around a core of advertising spots. Oh, joy! Montreal may be the venue where a new type of personal transportation will be manufactured. A Dutch firm, Spark Design, has plans for what amounts to a flying motorcycle that can operate on the road or in the air. These three-wheeled, two-seater vehicles look like a version of the Messerschmitt German tricycle that was on the road in the 50s, except that it has a retractable rotor on the roof. This machine is dubbed by its inventor, John Backer, a helicycle. This may seem like another pipe dream on the Bricklin model, except that several large corporations, including Boeing, Toyota, Honda, General Electric, and Pratt & Whitney, are all investigating the concept of the flying car. First came the trail bike, then the snowmobile, then the ATV. Bit by bit, our wilderness areas, not to mention our back roads, have been invaded by obnoxious, dangerous machines driven mostly by inconsiderate, over-testosteroned riders, leaving behind litter, pollution, and harassed wildlife. In the future, we may see these same people, no longer constrained by topography, able to fly into pristine areas to spread their mayhem. Beyond the horror of our having no place safe from motorized goofs, why would anyone choose to manufacture such machines in snowbound, high-wage Quebec? I suppose the answer may lie in a Canadian federal government program called the Technology Partnerships Canada Fund, or TPC. This fund was established to provide grants to companies that develop new products. The grants would be repaid from royalties on successful products. Doesn't that sound like a good idea? With TPC backing, the world's next Henry Ford, tinkering in his Canadian garage, would make a breakthrough that would reward him, Canadian society, and the federal government handsomely. Of course, the TPC fund was handed to the usual suspects to administer. It's become a conduit for our taxes to subsidize large corporations. The amount in royalties returned to the fund over the years has come to a whole 4% of the money invested. The largest recipient of TPC grants has been Pratt & Whitney, the same branch of an American parent that's looking into flying cars, as I just mentioned. This company has received $484 million for 7 projects so far, and it's demanding more on the threat that it will pull its operations out of Canada if the future grants are refused. Other companies on the government take for big bucks are giants like Ford, General Motors, and Bombardier. The dividends that these companies pay to their stockholders or parent companies are coming straight out of your pockets. Again, I ask why we would have to bribe profitable companies to manufacture in Canada. This is your Uncle Don coming to you on this 25th day of January 2005 on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Write to me at uncledon@cfur.ca. I saw a bumper sticker here in Prince George that read, "Mallwart, your source for sweatshop products." For some reason, that multinational giant, Walmart, has taken exception to this and other jibes that have been aimed at it. Walmart perceives itself, in the words of the late President Lyndon Johnson, as a pitiful, helpless giant. The billionaire Walton family cannot understand why theirs is the chain of stores that everyone loves to hate, or hates to love, as the case may be. Walmart is fighting back, in the States at least, with a multi-million-dollar advertising blitz aimed at reversing the image their stores have of a minimum-wage, job-destroying, anti-union, town-wrecking, slave-labor-promoting monster without ethics. Although all of the foregoing are true, rather than change the profitable reality, it would be more cost-effective to fog the reality with a cover of soft, cuddly, inaccurate advertising. They've started with full-page newspaper ads. The CEO of Walmart, Lee Scott, has said, "It is time to draw our own line in the sand." Oh, God, does this mean that the giant retailer will be going to Iraq? Not likely, at least not yet. Maybe when it is pacified. I mean Iraq. This advertising campaign will counter urban legends, as the company calls them, which see them accused of being an evil empire intent on destruction in the name of profit. Walmart has hired a public relations firm, Hill & Knowlton, to direct an image makeover presenting the real facts about the company. No prizes for anyone who remembers that where Hill & Knowlton made big headlines in the early 90s. This PR firm was hired by the government in exile of Kuwait after Iraq occupied the country in 1990. It was Hill & Knowlton that came up with the lie, totally fabricated, that Iraqi soldiers had thrown Kuwaiti babies out of hospital incubators. Hill & Knowlton arranged for the daughter of a Kuwaiti government official to perjure herself before a panel investigating the atrocity allegation. Hill & Knowlton arranged for a man to testify that he had witnessed the killing of babies. The American public reaction to this story was largely responsible for the wave of anger leading them to support Daddy Bush's invasion of Iraq and the subsequent punishing embargo. Watch for Hill and Knowlton to use its vast experience in lies and fabrications to present a grand and phony image of Walmart in the public mind. I wonder if they know that Colin Powell is on the job market. When a list of nations is assembled in the order of their imports from China, Walmart would fit in near the head of the list. In many fields of manufacture, China is the least expensive when it comes to labor, ahead of the sweatshops of the Caribbean and Africa. Until the first of this year, there were WTO quotas on textiles and clothing imports to Western countries, allowing desperately poor countries to build some industry. After the Christmas holidays, thousands of workers in Lesotho, a landlocked kingdom completely surrounded by South Africa and without notable resources, returned to work only to find their factories empty. Lesotho's quota for clothing imports was gone, and with it the jobs that supported a good proportion of the population. Lesotho still has some factories making clothing, but six closed over the holidays, and more will be leaving. Why? High wages that cannot compete with China's. Union? Not likely. Rich? How about $4 a day making overpriced fashion items for the likes of the Gap? How many pennies from the dollars you spent on that Gap t-shirt went to wages of those who made it? You figure. Then figure out how many pennies the company and the retailers saved by moving their production to China, where labor costs are less, as much of the work is done by prison labor. Walmart is merciless with suppliers, forcing them to cut costs so they can supply you with goods for less. Pennies count to the Waltons, the same folks who count their family fortune in the tens of billions of dollars. The next time you hear the Walmart ads telling you how great their prices are and how much they love their associates, ask yourself how those $4 a day workers in Lesotho are now supporting their families. Ask also why the company will close a store before allowing a union of their associates to share some of the power over their jobs that would make them take them a step toward becoming actual associates of those billionaires' owners. In 1908, Henry Ford introduced his Model T, a car that was produced, essentially unchanged, until 1927. That original Ford got 25 miles per gallon, at a time when gasoline was pennies a gallon, cheap enough that John D. Rockefeller's innovation of adding that little 9/10 of a cent onto the price made him a billionaire. Now, almost a century after that first Ford car, in a time of soaring oil prices and peaking supply, the fuel economy of the blended Ford fleet in 2004 was 23 miles per gallon. The recent auto show in Detroit was dominated by more powerful, larger, and more thirsty vehicles. To hell with Kyoto. Americans and Canadians want monster motor vehicles. Hard on the heels of General Motors' success in introducing the military Humvee to the civilian market as the Hummer, it's adapted another military vehicle, the Abrams tank, to the roads of North America. Under the banner of its Cadillac brand, this modified tank, minus its armor and armament, can now be seen lumbering around our cities. Take a look at the 2005 Cadillac models and you can see the resemblance. I resent the grumbling amongst the hoi polloi about the latest improvement in Canadian postal rates. What the hell, it's just another penny, plus GST, on a domestic letter. And we all know how useless a penny is today. Of course, that increase is just if you can keep your letter under 30 grams. Go over that weight and your increase is a nickel. But we all know how useless a nickel is today. That nickel improvement will also apply to the lightest letters to the states, and other postal rates have seen similar increases. But we should not quibble about these changes. The increase in revenue to Canada Post will allow the corporations to pay union wages to the contracted carriers, the ones who have to brave the weather to stuff my super mailbox a mere 3 kilometers from my door. The Canada Post Corporation can now afford to open a real post office in our end of town so we don't have to queue in the back of a drugstore for postal services. They will be able to resume Saturday deliveries, which were so foolishly deleted on the very day, years ago, when the first class rate went from 17 to 30 cents. Increased revenue from first class mail, which is actually well behind several other classes of delivery, will mean that they can eliminate the bulk crap that stuffs our mailboxes and litters the ground around them. Mail will be sped up, so we will once again be able to send a postcard in the morning inviting a friend to tea in the afternoon and have it delivered in time. When I was collecting stamps, I actually had such a postcard dating from about 100 years ago, and the card carried a penny stamp. Yes, indeed, all of these changes will take place, or I'm not the Tooth Fairy. Maybe royal dynasties are based on some good biology. It seems to be that talent runs in families, so perhaps a king should pass the crown on to his progeny. Talent running in families is certainly evident in business and politics. Look at how the Rockefellers managed to pass on keen judgment from John D. Rockefeller right down to the present generation of businessmen and politicians. The DuPonts have done the same, as have the Kennedys. Even Frank Stronach, the creator of Magna International, has passed his great skills on to his beloved Belinda, now a member of Parliament and a genius in her own right. The Bush family seem to have great talent carried on the Y chromosome from Prescott Bush through to the elder and younger Georges and even Jeb down there with the alligators in Florida. Although the bulbs appear dimmer as the Prescott genes are diluted through marriage, the talent is obviously still there. It might have expired in George Jr.'s daughters. I'm not the one to join the chorus of cynics who imply that this tendency to create dynasties has more to do with porous inheritance taxes and political connections than with inherited ability. To adhere to any such hypothesis would be to undermine my belief that my wife and I were able to retire early, solely due to our diligence in financial management. Our ability to retire was not enhanced by my inheriting buckets of money just a fortnight before my precipitous exit from the workforce. Even in British Columbia, we see evidence of genetically transported talent. Take our premier, Gordon Campbell, a man carried to power by a wave of popular revulsion at the building of a free deck on the home of his predecessor. Such deep corruption could not be tolerated in our pristine province, although Gordon's victory brought in a sea of hacks who promptly sold off our precious railway amidst allegations of profit payoffs and kickbacks. One of Gordon's closest advisors, touted as the hidden finance minister, is one Michael Campbell, Gordon's brother. His position of influence is based solely on his rare talents, without any considerations of his blood relations. This man, billed by the free press as the province's leading economist, again by merest coincidence, espouses the same right-wing causes as his illustrious brother. He must be very intelligent, as he does host a radio show, not on CFUR, called, are you ready for this, Money Talks. Does that tell you anything? A fortnight ago, at the Natural Resources Forum held here at UNBC, this brother of the premier stated, we've left the era of the welfare state. Governments made promises in the 1960s that they can't keep today. Michael neglected to mention that the government's supposed inability to afford care for its citizens might have some little thing to do with his brother's cutting income taxes by 25% the day after he took office. But eminent economists are busy looking into crystal balls and can be forgiven for overlooking wee bits of reality in the process of making grand pronouncements. Michael Campbell told the forum that George Bush is on the right track by changing the American Social Security system so that younger workers will not be contributing as much to the system while retirees continue to draw pensions. He also told the audience the U.S. government debt is another unresolved issue, not tying the two subjects together by explaining that decreased contributions to Social Security will increase that government debt by upwards of $1 trillion over the next 40 years. But then what do I know? I studied economics in the 60s when we learned that the welfare state could be afforded if only we were willing to put the tax burden where it belongs, on the rich and the corporate profits. Funny thing, but it seemed to work then. Now I can't tell you what Michael Campbell's academic training might be that has made him such an expert on finance, but he did make reference to the public's intuitive understanding of such complex issues as government debt and foreign exchange. Michael said that, we are in a period of major change in economics. You bet your bippy we are, if the infinitely complex business of administering the finance of governments is left in the hands of nincompoops who dismiss the knowledge of economics accumulated over centuries of study and experience. Trust the average Joe to know how to handle your financial structure, and we can go back to the economics of using coconuts for currency. Looking back at the relationship of the wise Michael Campbell to the wise Gordon Campbell, my belief that talent is inherited is strengthened. Now I can amend that hypothesis to state that lack of talent is also inherited. This has been your Uncle Don, the direst of circumstances, with my 121st rant for 25 January 2005. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I conclude with a quotation from the great Bertrand Russell. The infliction of cruelty with a good conscience is a delight to moralists. That is why they invented hell.